radicals of various stripes, and again, working in conjunction with people that might even be politically opposed to them outside of a disaster area. Disasters reveal the commonalities of humanity more than anything. And since climate change, man-made climate change is real, and coastal communities are under so much pressure to do this, this is going to become more and more common. And we're going to need more decentralized disaster relief efforts to happen. And I think we need to think about that as people in our communities to begin to build resilience now for the next disaster, whether it's economic, political, ecological, or war.
Scott, we have 10 seconds left. What are your final thoughts on the anniversary of Katrina moving forward?
It's sad that we haven't learned that much, that governments and nonprofits like Red Cross are still heavy-handed and uneven in their responses. But just remember the resilience of grassroots communities to do things and people to do it block by block and neighborhood by neighborhood in their own communities. That's how we're going to do it.
Scott Crowe, we want to thank you for being with us, and certainly Common Ground Collective that you helped co-found in New Orleans. On this anniversary, 12 years later, of Katrina, it's important to remember what an important force it became. I want to also thank Jonathan Katz, author and journalist. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with Renee Feltz. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have you received your KABU Silent Drive letter in the mail? Here is your chance to support your favorite community radio station and enter a chance to win some fabulous prizes. No letter? No worries. Go to KABU.fm to find out more about what you could win when you donate to KABU between now and September 14th. Here is a teaser. The grand prize is a week stay at El Dorado Resort and Casino with airfare in the biggest little city in the world. Yes, that's Reno, Nevada. The first prize is a night out on Burnside with a night at Jupiter Hotel, with dinner at Le Pigeon, drinks at Cedar Riot, and breakfast at Grendel's, so you can dive deep into the Burnside nightlife. And our second prize will allow you to stock up on medicinal and recreational treats at Jane PDX. Go to KABU.fm to donate. When we come together, we build our community's resilience, and there is no better time to invest in KABU than now.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. The Ingenio Milagro Playfest will feature four plays by Latinx playwrights and a concert readings over 3 days after a short rehearsal period. The playwrights will also get to work with the guest artist Daniel Jacquez. Again, that's Ingenio Milagro Playfest, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
Look out your window, as far as you can see, this beautiful country is our heredity. The way that we find it, the way we pass it on, the way that we remember. When we have come and gone, with the fire in the forest, we can't just let it burn. No one can do it for us, this much I've learned. There's a fire in the forest. Oh, the glory days of our material embrace have given us the destiny that we now must come to face, a monumental crossroads with no time left to borrow. And the choice we make today will be the world we get tomorrow. And there's a fire in the forest, we can't just let it burn. And no one can do it for us, this much I've learned. There's a fire in the forest. Can you drink your water? Can you breathe your air? Is there an unendangered species anywhere? Is there a land unthreatened by this historical machine? Is there a better vision? Can we find it in our dream? With the fire in the forest, We can't just let it burn. And no one can do it for us. And this much I've learned. That the fire in the forest. Talk about the future. Talk about a million years.
And good morning. Here we are once again, Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. And we're going to be talking about fires, but not exactly in the way that Jim Page was talking about it. We'll get into it. That was very metaphorical that you can't just let it burn. In fact, we should be, we'll talk about it with Brenna Bell. Good morning, Brenna.
Good morning, Paul.
So, using fire as an excuse to keep logging on Mount Hood, how to counteract Forest Service and industry propaganda. You are the staff attorney with BARC, which has been working to protect the forests, meadows, and waters of Mount Hood since
1999 was when BARC officially became an entity, but Greg and John had been doing work before they incorporated as a legal thing.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, almost 20 years of BARC.
I thought 93 was a little... In fact, 93, that's about when we started Cascadia Forest Alliance.
That was after the Salvage Rider. That was 95.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Anyway, fire in the forest. I can't just let it burn. Well, I mean, that's a very complex issue, which we'll talk some about. And we'll also be talking about, obviously, this huge, massive, crystal clear timber sale that's been proposed and is now accepting public comments for the next 3 weeks, and other subjects. And in about 20 minutes or so, we'll have Marie Knight, a very special guest, who's a cultural educator and native food gatherer, Warm Springs tribal member, who'll be talking about her own personal and family and native connections to the forests and meadows of Mount Hood, and her own take on the issue of fire. So let's get into this subject of fire right off the bat. We see the ravages of climate change all around the globe speeding up in a most disconcerting manner. Obviously, we can't even imagine, unless we were actually in Houston or in Bangladesh for that matter, what the massive flooding, the havoc it's causing on the lives of people. If we lived down, well, here we can smell the smoke. I certainly am smelling it. But if we lived down in southwestern Oregon, we would be probably choking on the smoke. I hear in Ashland, it's sometimes difficult actually to see, you know, more than 50 or 100 feet in front of you. Obviously, the people in Brookings are dramatically suffering it. And over the last few years with these massive wildfires, communities have been impacted more and more. People are losing their houses and such, just as they're losing their houses in the floods. So we see these accelerating impacts. But at the same time, we can't give in to the propaganda that is to continue logging as the supposed solution to these forest fires. So in a nutshell, before we get into a little more deeply, give us your elevator talk on fire and logging.
Well, I will first start by saying I'm not a fire ecologist. And if people are interested in fire ecology and want to get into the science behind a lot of what I'm saying, I really want to encourage you to look at the work of Dominic De La Sala and Chad Hansen, who are doing amazing work on fire ecology and working to educate lawmakers and legislators all over the country. They just had a New York Times article come out. They're awesome. I rely on their work, so I just want to name them up front with what I'm about to say.
And I'll link that. I didn't know about that article, but give me that information. I'll link that on my program page. I did link to a very recent article by George Werthner, who's also a very excellent writer on the subject of fire politics and ecology.
Okay. So having given sources, I think one of the things that people actually don't understand is that the fires that we're seeing now are not necessarily out of sync with the fire ecology. If you look over more like geo-ecological time, we have far bigger fires now than we had in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. both because of climactic changes and also because of the history of suppression. But most fire ecologists see that right now we're in a fire deficit and that these large fires might be starting to kind of right size the fires that are happening. The main thing that's happened because of climate change, people think, is that the fire season has grown longer. So it's not about fuels, actually. It's because weather is the dominant driver of all fire behavior. And fuels are not only secondary, but kind of tertiary to affecting a fire's behavior. And also, I will note that you said there's more communities who are being affected by fire than ever before, and that's because there are more people who are living in what's called the wildland-urban interface, or the WUI, than ever before.
Which is an analogy to these floods, just as
exactly.
So many articles are coming out about the total lack of regulation in the building boom in Houston and building in flood zones. People are building in fire zones.
They're building very high prone fire areas. And so introducing ignition points, introducing more fuels, and then just upping the social cost of a wildland fire, a fire that burns in a uninhabited wild forest usually has a lot of ecological benefit for the forest. A fire that burns people's houses down has a very different cost-benefit analysis if we're looking at it from the human impacts. And so we have more houses built in the forest and we have a longer fire season, but still, if you look at the graphs that start 200 years ago rather than 20 years ago, you'll see that we're not actually in a space of having more fires than we used to.
Okay, so that's the beginning point of the conversation. How about
Mount Hood? Oh, I didn't even talk about logging, though.
Well, we'll get into that. But how about Mount Hood itself?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of fire. Obviously, there'd be no difference between Mount Hood and anywhere right. else. There's no fires going on right now.
No, but there was a small one in the Clackamas recently, but that got nipped. Quickly.
Of course, the fire that happened on Warm Springs, that's very mm-hmm. near.
Very near.
Yeah.
And with Mount Hood, you have very different fire regimes. I mean, no forests burn the same, especially the east side and the west side of the Cascades. And the one thing to know, and I'm sure Marie will talk about this, is especially in the north and east part of the mountain, the native people co-evolved in time with the forests and burned it regularly. And there are fire ecologists who work on Mount Hood who recognize that we're actually at a deficit of human-caused fires on the east side of the forest, because for the 10,000 years that forest has existed, people were burning it regularly to tend for different plants. And when it became national forest, and, quote, protected from a cycle of anthropogenic interaction, the forest actually has suffered from lack of fire. There's not enough lightning strikes in the east side of Mount Hood to produce as much fire as the forest needs to stay in the same fire regime. It has to be set, which is something that people don't necessarily recognize, especially because of Smokey the Bear, right? You know, kids still are being taught only you can prevent wildfire. It's about like saying only you can prevent a hurricane. They're natural phenomena that the forests need to survive, and the idea that humans can or should stop them all, I think, is a huge fallacy based on timber interests. A dead tree is not as valuable.
And again, we'll talk about that, the history of a Forest Service excuses and rationales for continuing to log rapaciously, as they have for 5, 6, 7 decades now, as we go along. So this that struck me, that 10,000 years. It's not something you necessarily think about, that, you know, since it's not really that much time since the end of the last age has allowed this expansion right.
of the forest.
Re-expansion of the forest.
Yeah, and people in the forests really came kind of at the same time to this region.
Something to think about. So I'm talking with Brenna Bell, who's with the BARC, which is a forest watchdog group, hence, I guess, one of the reasons for calling it BARC. Obviously, the bark of trees. Anyway.
Well, it's actually named for the old English word, the barker, or the town crier, the person who goes and spreads the word about what is happening. It's kind of a weird name. We have to explain it a lot. But yes, it has also other meanings that one could look at, but it's not an acronym.
And the number to call in to join this conversation is 503-231-8187. Yeah, let's talk about fire as the one of the more recent excuses or rationales to continue what they have been chaining at the bit to keep doing since they've been restrained in the past 25, 30 years because of our efforts to stop this rapacious logging, which led to the Northwest Forest Plan and certain reductions on logging in certain areas. And of course, the salvage rider was probably the first effort to get around that back in 95, 96. And then not when did the fire rationale crop up?
You know, it's been growing steadily over the past 10 years, but the it's called the Crystal Clear Restoration Project. They have a way with words, the Forest Service. It is the biggest example, literally the hugest example we've seen of this. It's an almost 13,000 acre timber sale. It's almost entirely in northern spotted owl critical habitat. About a third of it is in mature or old growth forests. Much of it is in moist mixed conifer forest, which has a very long fire regime, similar to the west side of the Cascades. And they are justifying the entire thing by saying, we have to log these trees down. We have to kill these trees before they burn. And it's a very compelling political rhetoric. It's also a compelling legal rhetoric in the way that, if you remember good old George W. Bush and the Healthy Forest Restoration Act.
Yeah.
Again, doublespeak in the agencies or in government is amazing. The Healthy Forest Restoration Act focused on fast tracking and expediting logging in the wilderness, the wildland urban interface, and logging to prevent fire. And so this 12,725 acre timber sale is trying to fast track itself by saying that it is building more resilient forests by logging these mature and old growth areas that have never missed a fire regime, who if they burned would burn big and hot because that is their fire regime. And then also logging on the east side, on the whole border of Warm Springs, the entire north border of the Warm Springs Reservation pretty much is made up by this timber sale. So we're seeing them use this rhetoric of fire to justify a huge logging project. 39 miles of roads will be opened up. We know that roads have a huge negative impact. And then there's a massive disruption in habitat, all for the justification of making the forest more healthy. It's kind of crazy making when you get to it, because that has traction. Right now in the political environment, everyone's scared of fire. Fires like the Chetco Bar fire just, should we say, inflame those fears. And it's very hard now to argue rationally that logging has negative impacts, because it's now seen as the solution to every forest health issue. It's a miraculous rhetoric that the timber industry has introduced that has really caught traction. And it's hard now as the environmentalist to be like, no, we don't want restoration projects. No, we don't want healthy forests. Because what they're actually saying is, we're going to log the forest to save the forest. And we know that that's incorrect.
So in their actual presentation of this timber sale, that did they use this language? I mean, they talk about how they present this in the way they formal presentation.
The formal presentation is all couched in the rhetoric of making a more healthy, more resilient, less fire susceptible forest. Absolutely.
And they pretend to base that on actual science.
They do pretend to base it on actual science, yes.
And so
unfortunately the document came out. BARC has a 2-week long base camp where we have hundreds of people out in the forest ground truthing or hiking all the units of this huge timber sale. It started on Thursday. And we're like, yeah, it's going to start in We should have placed wagers, except everyone would have betted on the Forest Service then releasing their document right when base camp started, because they're evil that way. And sure enough, Friday morning, boom, there it comes, 335-page document with a month-long comment period right when we started our serious ground truthing of the project. So it only came out on Friday. I haven't read the entire thing cover to cover. But the agency usually relies on its own specialists for science, and a lot of them are amazing people who love the forest and really work to do good work. They also need to keep their jobs, which means their science is suspect in some ways. It's not peer reviewed, and it can be edited by their district ranger. So I think that makes it harder to trust that the agency's own science from its internal district will ever go counter to the decisions that it needs to make. And so we bring in a lot of peer-reviewed science and argue for the best available science to be used, but that's still not commonplace in the agency decisions.
And one would, of course, always, maybe some people would think that a public agency would, in supposedly having the public interest at heart, would actually rely upon the best peer-reviewed science, but apparently not. And so your job, strangely, paradoxically, is actually to interact with them. That's been your BARC's role since its existence, is largely, I guess you're not exclusively involved in Forest Service stuff, but mainly.
But almost, yeah. Yeah.
So your role as a watchdog group is to do track all the as many of the projects that they're involved in as you can, and to get yourself involved with them. So I know there's a lot of stuff we have to talk about. I know we want to bring Marie into the conversation real quick, which is really important since, as you said, this project is all along the northern boundary of the Warm Springs Reservation. But talk a little bit about how you do interact with the Forest Service and, you know, some of the victories you've had, some of the what you're actually able to achieve in interacting with the Forest Service.
Well, there's a lot there. And, you know, I want to say we have a whole suite of tools that we use, and a lot of it depends on the personalities who are guiding the agency at any given time. And one would like to hope that that wasn't true, but we're relational beings, animals, and the way we relate to each other affects what BARC does. One of the most important things we do is we get people in the forest. We get people in the forest through a monthly free hike. We teach people about the forest at our ecology club, and we ground truth as much acreage of every single extractive project as we can, which is why we're having a 2-week-long base camp right now in the Crystal Clear Timber Sale, getting people's boots on the ground and gathering information about what's really there. The Forest Service does not have a very big budget right now. It's been steadily shrinking since the heyday of the 90s. It was already small, and with the Trump administration, it's shrinking even more. And they simply don't have the people to go out there and survey everything and find everything. And so we get people out there and gather information. And then when something like a NEPA document comes out, like this 335-page assessment for
National Environmental Policy Act.
Thank you. Comes out and we have the opportunity as the public to comment on it, then we use all the information that we've been gathering on the ground and put it in comments. And we do more than that. We call the specialists, we talk to them, we build personal relationships with them. We're part of, there's 3 different collaborative groups on the forest, and BARC sends staff to all of them. I will note that this project, the Crystal Clear project, did not get planned with a collaborative group and never had the opportunity to go through that kind of stakeholder vetting that the collaborative groups do. The Forest Service said, we need, this was before the fire rhetoric came out. The district ranger said, we need to do a straight up timber sale to get shelf stock for board feet to meet our timber quotas. At the collaborative group I was at, I said, wow, you're sure being honest.
So backtrack a second before you make your point. You're making timber quotas. What does that mean?
Oh, every national forest has a set timber quota, some amount of board feet that they are supposed to log, every year. And that's kind of set as a, both by national and local, they kind of work out the most the forest can possibly cut with its budget and its workforce. Mount Hood National Forest's current timber quota is 35 million board feet per year. And that's been fairly consistent about the past 10 years. And this particular sale is supposed to log about 60 million board feet, almost double the annual quota of the forest over several years. And so it's the contribution of the Barlow Ranger District to the timber quota. And so when I was sitting in a collaborative group and heard Cameron Sam, the district ranger from Barlow, say that, I was like, what is going on? You are being honest. And I asked, I said, yeah, you're still calling this a restoration project. Why is that? And he said, well, we're going to be decommissioning some roads. They're decommissioning 0.3 miles of road in the thing. But I like the rhetoric of restoration. So we work with them on lots of different levels and try and get the Forest Service to incorporate our information and then to make decisions that are in line with the laws, regulations, and policies that they need to follow. And every now and then we end up suing them. And sometimes we win. And so, there's a lot of forest that's saved because of that.
So basically you make your comments and you get involved in these collaborative projects. So what happens will be that you'll maybe reduce the board feet, maybe put more protection on certain riparian areas or around certain endangered species or various ecological aspects or forest quality aspects. You might, reduce the road building. There's various things you could do. Or the hope is that you might actually eliminate a timber sale entirely, which I guess is your goal.
And that was more common when their timber sales were a lot smaller. They used to plan 500-acre timber sales, 200-acre timber sales. They'd maybe have 10 of them going at once. And if we could make a very strong case why one of them was illegal, they could drop it. Now they're putting all their eggs in one basket. You know, their entire timber quota met by this one huge timber sale. And we're looking at other tactics. And one of the tactics we're looking at isn't limited to just affecting the sales anymore. We want to change the forest plan that tells the Forest Service how to manage the land. We realized that if we just keep pushing back on them following a plan, an outdated plan from 1990 that basically says log the forest, that's the primary goal in most of these areas. If we don't change the plan itself, we'll always be fighting an uphill battle. So BARC has launched a new campaign to try and amend this 27-year-old forest plan and bring in better science, bring in science about fire ecology. Like back to the original topic, the 1990 forest plan has this to say about fires: put them all out. Full stop. And so, you know, it says nothing about climate change. Obviously, it was adopted in 1990. It doesn't really talk about recreation, which is the biggest economic boon of the forest, is recreation. And it doesn't talk about any of that. So we are hoping to build the momentum to amend the forest plan. And if we did that, we wouldn't have to keep trying to fight huge, ridiculous timber sales in places that they never should have been proposed.
So really quick, I know we have Marie Knight on the line. We'll welcome her in just a second here. So this base camp is going on. You're inviting the public to go out there. Around where is it?
I don't know. You were just there, Paul.
I was just there. It's right off of Highway 26.
I haven't actually gotten up yet.
Right off of Highway 26. And you can go to the BARC website, which is bark-out.org. Mm-hmm. And all this is on the program page at kboo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And we can also give out the phone number. I know there's some people who still are not on computers for various reasons. So if we could give out that phone number at some point.
Sure, well, I'll do it right now. Our BARC's office number is 503-331 0374, and you are welcome to call us and ask about Basecamp. It'll be going till September 7th, and you are invited to come camp with us and get your boots on the ground up in the Crystal Clear area. Or just call if you have questions about anything that came up in the show and you weren't able to call in.
And you obviously have your office over there just off of Sandy on 18th in Northeast Portland. So we got that. So let's bring Marie Knight, a Warm Springs tribal member, a cultural educator, and native food gatherer. Good morning, Marie.
Good morning.
And I guess you've been hearing this program. Maybe you could just have whatever comments you might have about the way the conversation's been going so far.
Well, it's been going pretty good. What I really want to start off with is a little bit of a history of the tribal significance of the area. See, traditionally, you know, our people, the native Tahoptin people, they would travel in these different areas around the Pacific Northwest, and we weren't nomadic. We lived in different areas depending on when the food was ready to be harvested, you know, when the salmon were coming up the river, when the deer were ready to be hunted. And every season we would move our camps to different areas. And so traditionally, controlled burns were part of our land management practices for areas where the roots and the berries would be going thin or thinning out and dying and not reproducing. And we would like burn an area every few years or so to maintain the seeds, like help the seeds sow and help them reproduce and come back stronger in, you know, the following years. And this practice was upheld because the areas would be vacated before the fires would be started. And the fires would be burned in, you know, small areas, just these certain fields, and they would be monitored by people, you know, keeping it, you know, like monitored by our men and our women, making sure that they didn't get out of hand or didn't get too wild.
But and it was
even
probably,
if the fire had spread, the area would already be vacated because there were no permanent homes.
And it was probably somewhat analogous to the way that controlled burns are done now, which is obviously they were intelligent enough not to probably start these burns in the height of the hot and dry season.
Yes, they would do these in a time when there would be more natural waterfall, more readily available moisture in the air, so that the weather didn't help promote, you know, higher temperatures and strong winds and things like that. And so, and the lack of permanent homes also made it a more practical practice, because we weren't worried about our permanent homes being damaged from fires getting out of control. And one of the things that our tribal treaty had procured was the right to gather and hunt in our traditional lands, which are between the Confederated tribes of Warm Springs, Yakima, and Umatilla. But unfortunately, because of federal policy, we weren't able to continue our traditional land practices.
Mm-hmm. And so the lands.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Did you have a question?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, when I went up to Bark this weekend, I was really looking at the area from a traditional food gatherer's perspective, because one of the things I'm very concerned about is the amount of fields that are being reported as being dried or barren because of the lack of fire or because of over-harvesting. Because our berries are being exploited, you know, by a lot of people. A lot of people are selling them. There's a lot of damaging harvesting practices that are killing off of very healthy bushes. And, you know, a lot of the areas that we go to also are occupied by wild animals, like bears. Bears love huckleberries, and that is, and they do go wherever berry fields are. And when I actually wanted to, you know, touch about the Smokey the Bear, because I remember Smokey the Bear, the comics that they had put out to talk about his story and how the fire had devastated the area and killing his family and him being horribly burned in the accident. And I remember people talking about, you know, preventing wildfires But see, this happened back in 1994, and from my records and what I looked at as far as history in the areas, it seems like the wildfires have actually gotten bigger and more devastating ever since the forestry practices have, started clear cutting instead of, fire management. And it really seems like, especially since, in the last 5 years, I see fires burning. Like there was a fire just south of Mount Hood, the area where we are land surveying right now on the reservation, that was completely burned through. There's fires currently going on in Warm Springs right now. Like, it wasn't that long ago that we had another fire that was just as devastating, going through the entire Pacific Northwest. And to me, it just seems really, counterproductive to clear cut because these wildfires are still happening. And when I was out up on the mountain this last weekend surveying one of the areas that had recently been clear cut, there were two areas that I looked at, and one had been clear cut several years ago, and the other one had just recently been clear cut, just this year. And the area where it had been clear cut before, it was very dusty. The ground was absent of any kind of significant plants, like berry bushes. We have Oregon grape root out there. I know ferns are a major part of it. Our wild grasses are made, important part of, these structures that are on the ground, but they're not there. They're mostly absent from these areas where the logs have been cleared out. And part of the reason why clear cutting is devastating for the land is because our berries, our roots, and our traditional foods, our traditional plants, they thrive on these dead logs, these nurse logs that traditionally fall and rot and fall apart right on the ground. And these are what provide the nutrients that our traditional foods and our traditional plants need in order to thrive. And they were mostly absent in these areas that were clear cut. And one of the things that really disturbed me was the most recent clear cut area had a wood pile of branches that was at least 30 feet high, and I want to say at least, 50 to 60 to maybe 30 feet wide. And that huge pile, if lit on fire, would cause a major bonfire and would definitely cause a major fire on the hill, which seems extremely counterproductive to, the purpose of clear cutting, especially since the area around the pile where all the logs had been removed was mostly dusty, mostly covered with bark and sticks and debris from other plants. There was a lot of trees that were damaged in the process, where the trees had landed and hit. There was bark stripped away. There was, branches broken off. I mean, it was just heartbreaking seeing the land just torn up like that.
So the logging changes the ecosystem of the forest and also the microclimate, which has a major impact on the possibility of fire starting. So the voice you heard is Marie Knight, again, a Warm Springs tribal member, a cultural educator and native food gatherer. I've also been speaking with Brenna Bell with the forest watchdog group BARC, is having their base camp out in the area that I was actually out there when Marie was giving a talk just the other night. We only have about 20 minutes left, and there's just so much to cover, and we haven't had anybody call in yet, which you're welcome to do at 503-231-8187. So this area that you were at, you mentioned that there's these treaty relationships between the Warm Springs, which involves what are called the ceded lands, which is these vast areas surrounding the reservation, which is where the Warm Springs maintains greater sovereign control, and the rights to gather, hunt, and gather, but a lot of people, may not have such a strong awareness that people have continued to to do those things in those areas. So do you have your own personal family connection to the, you know, both that area and other areas that are on the Mount Hood National Forest?
Absolutely. My family actually used to gather in the Washington area, and Mount Hood, we did a lot of harvesting around that area, but you know, traditionally we went to all these different areas that were, like I said, in between these three major Confederated tribes. And one of the things I wanted to include was that even though there was an absence of traditional indigenous plants in the area, one of the things I also saw as an opposite was an overabundance of invasive species mm-hmm. that would not be thriving had they been burned out. And to me, that also shows like how the economy has been changed, because now the invasive species are having a more friendly environment, inviting them in, and our traditional foods are actually being suffocated under these practices. And, you know, my cultural ties to the areas are very strong, because my family has, you know, from the time I was a young girl, had taught me to be a traditional food gatherer. And I was raised on a lot of stories about, you know, different hunting and different, you know, gathering stories. And so for me, this is my personal history going up there, and these are traditional lands where my ancestors had once set foot. And when I went up there, what I was seeing was a lot of life, a lot of signs of life, a lot of signs of bears, and I also saw multiple signs of beavers out in the area just right near where the camp was. And one of the things I want to emphasize too is that there had been a fire that went through there, as evident by some of the charcoal logs that were still left and, you know, surrounded by new growth. And one of the logs I found that were burned had previously been chewed up by beavers, which says that, you know, the beavers had been there for a long time. And for me, this is putting, you know, endangered species in even more danger. And prior to going to this area, I had also gotten reports that, you know, there had been wolves sighted in the area.
That's right.
Yes, wolves being sighted in the area, which is really a good sign for the land and the forest, because that is a sign that the forest is healthy enough to support more life, because that means there is more game attracting the wolves. And, you know, the wolves coming in and helping to clear out some of these other predators, some of these other plant eaters, will help the plants start to thrive more. I mean, the wolves coming in will help. It helps in a lot of ways. And the opposite of that with clear cutting is that it exposes the, you know, the land, it exposes the dirt, it rips out a lot of significant plant life that holds, you know, the topsoil in place. And during the rainy seasons, a lot of that soil is going to wash away, it's going to get into the streams, which are going to have effect on the salmon. When the salmon are affected, that affects the food supplies, you know, down the stream, the people, you know, the animals that rely on them. I mean, it's just an entire cycle that we're trying to, because I'm trying to support the cycle that promotes the healthy forest, where, you know, we do have these natural predators and these animals coming back to the area. And I fully understand the dangers of fires, because several years ago, I remember the fires devastating most of Washington and Oregon, and I had, you know, said, you know, I really feel for the people that had lost their lives, the people that had lost their homes, and this is going to be something that the land needs. You know, and oftentimes, you know, it's very difficult because, you know, the needs of the land, the traditional foods, are being, you know, ignored in favor of, you know, human and economic development.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marie, we only have about 15 minutes left. I know Brenna wants to interact here too. There's this one really important thing. This huge crystal clear timber sale, information about which you can find both by going to the BARC website and by going to my program page, kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And again, you're encouraged to both read information, you the listener, about these and go out to this base camp and look at the area and make comments, informed comments about this project, because you actually can have an impact about whether or not it goes through, and if it unfortunately does go through, how it is carried out. Mm-hmm. So people are encouraged to do that. But again, this is on the almost the entire length of the Northern Warm Springs Reservation boundary. I know you are an enrolled member, but you are just a single tribal member. You obviously mm-hmm. cannot speak for officially for the tribe or for mm-hmm. any other tribal members, but you know, you do have your own personal and family history and tribal connection. I don't imagine you know much about what the Warm Springs position, if any, on this particular timber sale or other logging issues. Do you?
Well, I would think that, you know, the Warm Springs forestry industry would be in favor of some timber sales, or even at the very least, thin cutting. Or and I don't know enough about the forestry practices over there, but I do know that Warm Springs does need to be able to, you know, come back, you know, needs to be able to secure financial security and needs to be able.
Well, I'm not talking about logging on the reservation. I'm talking about
I know that it has to do with relation to this, and I really don't know what their view is, but what I would like to see them doing is supporting more practices that do encourage, you know, growth and health of traditional foods.
Mm-hmm. And their own treaty rights on these areas.
Yes.
So
treaty rights did specifically, you know, address the need to be able to gather and hunt in our traditional grounds, which, you know, really states that at the time this was written, that our first foods were the first priority of our people.
I'm kind of compressing things here. I apologize that. I know there's mm-hmm. You have so much to talk about in this deep history and your own. It'd be mm-hmm. interesting to hear your own, more of your own personal and family stories about it. Unfortunately, the limitations of radio are such. But mm-hmm. you know, this fire just happened on Warm Springs, and it started mm-hmm. just off the reservation, much further east, the northeastern boundary, mm-hmm. and devastated parts, including I believe a relative of yours' house, a friend of mine's house, lost their house, which is something hopefully we'll have some chance to talk about on a future show, because they have some very interesting ideas about rebuilding that house and making rebuilding other houses that are lost to fires with fire-resistant materials, but that's a subject mm-hmm. for another time. But so, you know, this is a very real problem on the Warm Springs Reservation. Just about every summer, there's destructive wildfires. And again, so I imagine this is all speculative, but I imagine part of the Forest Service getting the Warm Springs tribe on board with this project, or at least not having them oppose it, might be that this is protection from fire. And again, this is very speculative, but you know, knowing what we know, this is not unreasonable. So this is a very, very current issue for the Warm Springs tribe and their relationship to the Forest Service. And I know asking you to comment all this is a very big thing, but you know, it just cropped into my mind. I mean, do we know how that fire started off the reservation, for one thing?
I personally don't know. There have been some speculation, but I really don't know myself.
And again, this very very big issue to get into. But so this mm-hmm. issue of fire, the reservation border, these are again very important things to have a very clear understanding of how fire works. First of all, mm-hmm. I know, Brenda, you've probably been wanting to jump into the conversation.
Oh no, I love listening to Marie. That was great. But I do want to just acknowledge something you said and really agree. You said that fire is very good for the forest and for bringing back first foods, but not necessarily for the human interests or economic interests. And I think that that is it in a nutshell. The Forest Service, since its beginning, has put fires out. It used to have what was called the 10 a.m. policy, where it wanted to stop every single fire that started by 10 a.m. the next morning. And the entire purpose of that was to protect the timber resources for logging, to protect the forest from burning so that it could be killed in a more economic way. And I think that when we mess with the cycles of nature for too long, it comes back to haunt us. And the colonial cultural approach to all fire is bad, first of all, completely negated the traditional ecological practices that were happening all over the Northwest with burning. And second, propped up resource extraction for economic purposes as the primary function of the forests. And we're seeing that continuing almost 100 years later. We're seeing that still continuing as how the Forest Service is approaching this in that area. They say the worst thing that could possibly happen would be that this forest experiences fire, which is natural and usually healthy for forest regeneration. And so we're going to kill it ourselves instead and make a profit. It's just perpetuating a colonial attitude towards a natural ecosystem.
Well, I know we've got two callers been waiting very patiently for a long time, but I'll ask you to hold off another couple minutes because, Marie, I'd like you to just respond to what I was talking about the politics of fire and Warm Springs and the Forest Service and what Brenna just said.
Well, I'd like to see the tribe taking more lead from the farmers that are over in Madras that do controlled burns on their field. Mm-hmm. They have small controlled burns, you know, to maintain their crops. And I know that I don't know that the tribe has the resources for it, but I know that we could definitely, you know, probably save more homes, more lives, and a lot more resources by doing more preventative actions when we have fire seasons. There have been, you know, homes and lives lost almost every year due to fires, which to me says that, you know, the practice of thinning really doesn't, you know, it's not as effective as, you know, they like to claim it is.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I have not been such a good talk show host, and I let our two phone callers go away because I guess they got tired of waiting. I apologize for that. But if anyone does have a call, we do have about 8 minutes left, 503-231-8187. This is a very important conversation. I do want to give, it's a very complex one too. So it's important to get your voices out there in full.
And Paul, I want to flag something maybe for that future conversation with what you and Marie were both saying about losing homes. There is a whole body of research that's being developed over the past 20 years of how to make a house more fire resilient, not necessarily resistant, but fire resilient. And there is there are so many practices that could be done and getting the word out about them. In some counties, perhaps making them part of coding or zoning laws. If you are building in fire-prone areas, you have to have a metal roof, say, or things like that, or clearing vegetation around 400 feet around your home. Things that are fairly simple practices that can make homes more fire resilient would go a long way to actually protecting homes, much more than logging in the forest 5 miles from your house would.
Yes, I think it would also be a good practice to create fire lines prior to fire seasons. That way, those lines are already in place to help protect the homes as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and creating a buffer. And if, you know, Brenna mentioned the Forest Service budget. We're talking about the Warm Springs tribe. And obviously, they probably have their own budgetary difficulties and probably could use a lot of support and perhaps encouragement in terms of, you know, dealing with putting in place these kind of protective measures for their own residents. So of course, something that we as a non-tribal member don't have much
federal policy as well, because we do we are under federal law on the reservation. We're not under state law.
And it looks like George is back. So go ahead, George, you're on the air. Hello?
Right, sure. So I wasn't able to hear about 15 minutes of the show. But I was wondering if you haven't already, I think what I heard, you've already underlined, your guests have underlined the real problem the fact that our entire forest approaches and science are dominated by this absolutely out of control opportunistic economy of investment for profits for private corporations. And I just wonder if you've already covered this. I think from what I've heard you have, but if you have any comments on that. And don't we need to be thinking about some kind of an economy where, you know, the forests and Mother Earth and justice for all creatures and people are first. Anyway, I'll hang up because I know you've got a lot of things to talk about. Thanks again. Bye now.
Well, yes. Yes, George, I think that economy would be much better for all beings. And you are absolutely right that forest policy is directed by corporate interests. I do want to touch on something, bring something in to highlight that right now. As I spoke earlier about doublespeak, there is a new federal legislation called the Resilient Federal Forest Act of 2017. And you may guess where this is going. Of course, it wants to strip environmental protection from national forests and make it a lot easier for the timber industry to extract more without public oversight or protective laws. And it's already pretty easy because that's been the thrust of the agency since it was created. And that is a bill that's currently in the House of Representatives, and I have a special request. If any of you listeners are in Representative Kurt Schrader's district, he is still undecided on this bill. It came forward in 2015, and he voted yes and was an enthusiastic supporter, and in part because he said that forest fires are a devastating force and we need to be able to log the forest to protect them from fires. So again, using that fire rhetoric to justify commercial timber extraction. And he needs to get all the calls and letters from his constituents that we can drum up to let him know that the value of the forests is far more than the timber that can be extracted for the industry. I mean, just one thing I think we can all recognize is the water, the drinking water. 98% of Mount Hood National Forest flows into somebody's drinking watershed, and it's so important to protect the water, to protect the most economic benefit from the forest right now is honestly coming from outdoor recreation, and to protect cultural values like Marie was speaking about, like first foods and things that get completely ignored and bowled over by timber interests. So again, that's the Resilient Federal Forest Act. I think it's H.R. 2936.
Is there anything similar going on in the Senate?
Yes, it's not as far along, but Senator Thune from North Dakota put something out in the Senate that would have a similar impact, and we're targeting Ron Wyden on that.
I just want to interject some of this unrelated, but I flagged this. I got a Facebook post about this regarding lawmakers. Peter Courtney appointed State Senator Alan Olson to the Oregon Global Warming Commission. That's the Democrats appoint a known climate denier to the group supposed to come up with our climate plans. He was rated awful in Willamette Week's 2017 ratings of Portland area lawmakers. He's a strident climate change denier. So you can call Lisa Herzog at 503-986-1604 in Peter Courtney's office to register your complaint about that. We only have a couple of minutes left. Marie, some final words on what we're talking about here.
Well, my final word on this really is if we bring back fire management, we bring back more food. And for tribal people that know how to use the food, that will help us maintain sustainability because it provides a food source that we don't have to rely on the government to receive or, you know, other companies. It's during the Great Depression, our family didn't really experience the depression the same way most of America did because we did live off the land. We got our food through natural practices. And so the deficit that had swept through the nation during the Dust Bowl didn't really affect our people because we still had that knowledge and those practices to keep us secure.
Wow. That's something really, to chew on.
That really is my final thought right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, that's a good one. And that has to be pretty close to our final thoughts. Brenna, last words about the base camp and people plugging in here.
Well, one last word of thanks to Marie. It was great to be on the air with you. And if people are interested in all things public lands, Mount Hood, fire, climate change, logging, please do check out BARC. Again, our website is bark-out.org. And we invite you to join us in the forest right now up at the forest known as the Crystal Clear Timber Sale.
Yes,
okay.
I want to say I did enjoy this as well. When I went up there, it's very beautiful up there. I enjoyed my time, and I enjoyed the talk, and enjoyed meeting you guys as well.
So go out, camp out in the woods. Last days of summer here. Thank you very much, Brenna and Marie.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 7th Annual Arab Festival, Saturday, September 2nd at Oaks Amusement Park in Portland. The 7th Annual Arab Festival will feature delicious, authentic cuisine, music, dance, poetry, fun activities for all ages, and much, much more. Admission is free. Again, that's the 7th Annual Arab Festival, Saturday, September 2nd from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Oaks Amusement Park, 7805 Southeast Oaks Parkway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, KBOO members. Join us at the KBOO annual meeting on Saturday, September 9th from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. The annual meeting is an opportunity for our members to come together, hear a report about the state of the station, and celebrate our community. This year, the meeting is dedicated to Michael Wells, who tragically passed on earlier this summer. As we celebrate the legacy of Michael, we will listen to some of the youth who contribute to our community and to what it means to follow their leadership. We hope to see you on Saturday, September 9th, from 10:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. That's 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland.